And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lisa's right about America being a land of opportunity, and maybe it deals has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, you know. But that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Drawing a blank. Okay, this next show is gonna be really freeform. I do not have any script, just outlines. So excuse me if I ramble / jump around topics a bit. The general topic this hour is Jewish history. As someone who's raised Jewish, I could consider myself a lapsed Jew. I now identify as a positive atheist. That is an atheist who is for humanistic values and also known as a weak atheist, meaning it's not that I assert there's no deities and gods. It is more that I do not care enough to, and I do not see any reason to believe in it. So I do not consider myself a person of faith, so take that as your grain of salt. As I talk about Jewish history, I think it I would lend a interesting perspective talking about the religion I was raised in, so I know quite a bit about it, bar mitzvahed myself, and know how to practice. You know, I know the practices better than others. I just don't do it willingly. But otherwise, it's still very good. It's, you know, it's binding, binds us together, has, you know, part community and family obligations, which I gladly have. So how to start the story? So probably the reason why I was inspired to even talk about Jewish history. First, I think it's something that I don't see enough of from a secular perspective, from an even atheist perspective. In the atheist community where I got my start in activism, we never really talk about Judaism much. It was kind of almost a third rail to talk about Israel, Zionism, and Judaism in general. Either because of the minority situation of being so strong, you know, it's not like Jewish law is going to be made the law of the land, you know, but there are Jewish theocrats. But, you know, the priority here in America is that there are Christian fundamentalists who are for theocracy. They want biblical law being the law, you know, ban homosexuality, oppress sexual and other types of minorities, and just generally have ultra-conservative beliefs that they want to enforce on everyone else, as it is a moral truth to them. So, but I'm not going to go into all of that memorable role. I want to keep things focused. Maybe I'll hit that back at the end of the hour. But I just want to stick with either the facts or the strongest theories and hypotheses of archaeologists and historians. And also come at things from the way Jews talk about ourselves. So the link that I'm going to have in the show notes, in the podcast version of the show is podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, etc., is from jewishhistory.org. And there's nothing in particular I'm going to read from here. I'm just kind of using it because it has a great list of the major story beats of Jewish history. Jewish history is has a similar track as most human history. I mean, you can divide it into stages. The way I do it as a history nerd myself is that you have a Neolithic age, you know, prehistory. You have the Bronze Age where you have writing, so there is a bit of a historical record. Bronze Age collapses, and then you have an intermediate period between that and what is, I will call, the Classical Age, you know, Rome, Greek, classical Greece, you know, your togas and all that. And then, and I'm just talking from European point of view here, European and Middle Eastern point of view. Then you have a second intermediate period at the fall of Rome. You know, you have a collapse of classical civilization, and then you have in another intermediate period, also known as the Middle Ages, until 1500 or so. You have the Renaissance, and then you basically have the modern age, which we're kind of still in, I would say, because most of our culture and society and stuff can mostly be traced back to the Renaissance era as far as values and the way things are set up. It was in the Renaissance era that capitalism started to develop. And so to look into the future and project a little bit, I think, you know, 500 years is usually a good kind of length of time that these, you know, non-intermediate stages happen, modern age. And so we'll have a similar collapse with multiple shocks, you know, political decline, ecological disaster. I was just talking about that. And, you know, of course, there's a resistance. There's the means to stop. There's a desire to stop it. But I'm a little cynical as far as that. I think it's but to know what is coming, and that's why I study history. It kind of gives me some grounding to see myself and other, everything I'm doing in a context that to prepare for the next intermediate period. You know, the experiments we're doing, the new society we're dreaming of, happened in the similar times in the Bronze and Classical Ages. How is this relevant? Well, that is where the story of Judaism begins. It begins in the end of the Bronze Age. There were ideas about having an experiment of not being so polytheistic and kind of having monotheism, one chief god, or one god that is more important above other gods. There was a pharaoh in Egypt in the New Kingdom era who experimented with this. Didn't catch on. A lot of resistance to it. It was kind of like movements we have today. And elsewhere. And of course, we have, I don't know exactly what to call it. I guess I'll just call it the Levant so I can use a neutral term, not use the term Israel, Palestine, or what have you. So I'll just call, say, the Levant area to talk about the geography. And because it's nestled between two empires at the time, Bronze Age. And the short version, I suppose, is the Bronze Age civilizations, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Hittites, Mycenae, which is in Greece, Indus Valley, they all collapse. Mostly all at the same time, within a century. What caused it? There's a brilliant talk. I'll have to find that and link to it as well. It's like an hour lecture, but it's fascinating. It was everything all at once. Like, there's a bunch of earthquakes, there's an ecological disaster, and there was also general decline, political decline. You know, you have more inequality, and it could, you know, the system can still perpetuate, you know. Pharaohs and kings still have armies to defend themselves and their nobles with. But then things get a little bit worse, and then mass rebellion breaks out. And the hypothesis I like, and I will also link to this documentary, it was a Nova special from a decade or so ago, and it puts forward, based on archaeological evidence, that the Israelites were, in fact, the lower-class Canaanites who rebelled at the end of the Bronze Age. You know, fed up with their rulers, and they burned down the cities. So the reality, or rather the, you know, the truth, that you had a mass uprising, and then a generation or so later, they write stories about how it was a conquest from the outside, because as a lower class, they see themselves as outsiders. You know, they're alienated and stuff. And what do you do when society collapses? You go for the hills. And that's where Jerusalem sits, and in all these other communities. They sit in the hills. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And so it was, and in the, you know, and the thing that happens after a collapse, all these different ideas that were percolating under the surface but couldn't really take root because the establishment had a monopoly, and these other new ideas didn't take root. Ideas like monotheism, ideas like having a phononic alphabet. You know, writing before was scratches and pictures, like hieroglyphs. But it was after the Bronze Age collapses, then you have more phononic alphabets, like the Semitic alphabet, Hebrew, and in Phoenicia, which is now Lebanon. And a bunch of other new ideas of governance and such, like republics and so on. And it's becoming the ultimate outsider. So you have the establishment of the formation of a not the Jewish kingdom, but the Israelite kingdom. After a century, a few generations, things build up again, and you have a king again. The House of David, which there's a record of it. Archaeology is cool in that, you can confirm certain aspects of the Bible, Torah or otherwise, with outside sources. It can't just be someone talking about themselves. That's not good evidence. You need someone else talking about them too. And usually they talk about them in a biased way, like usually how they beat them. like when an Egyptian pharaoh mentions Israel, he talks about how he beat them, and he did, in a raid. And stole a bunch of stuff, but at least he mentions Israel. So we knew that at this year, at 1200 BCE, there was an Israel. And in a few centuries later, from the north, an Assyrian king talks about how he fought the house and conquered the House of David. So a few centuries later, we know there's a House of David. So that there was a dynasty of sorts. And the evidence, archaeological and otherwise, based on pottery and other things, is that although there was a one chief god, there was still a practice of polytheism. Still many other minor deities. You have your mother goddess with a great chest area, indicative of of maturity and being of good mothership, and other gods as well, other deities. But this is why, it is written in the Torah that you have the prophets who speak of doom and gloom and how, we need to change our ways. We need to stop being polytheistic. And so how much of this was written after the fact? Well, most of it, if not all of it. And when was it written? Well, it was written because soon after you have the Assyrian Empire come about. Empires start to establish themselves again, the internet. Society builds itself, a civilization, as it were, builds itself back up with hierarchies and so on. And the Assyrians invade and conquer Israel and take what you usually do, a bunch of hostages, and put them back in Babylon. So it's called the Babylonian exile. And this was the educated class of Israel. So it's kind of talked about and written about as if it was the entire population. I sincerely doubt it. I think it was just the educated, the ruling class, the upper class, that's who you take as hostages. That way without you take them away, and then the rest of the population just has to go along to get along. And so in their exile, they become the ultimate outsiders, first exile. And so they rewrite all of the stories and whatever, and they start rethinking about things. And the conclusion that, historians and archaeologists come to is, okay, why did our God forsake us? Why were we conquered? Sometimes you, as is usually the practice, you then start praying to your conqueror's God. But in this case, because they were already experimenting with monotheism, having an internal law instead of rules, they stuck with it and then rewrote and wrote the Torah and so on to have their own narrative in place. To explain that, it was because they were still polytheistic. So from now on, completely monotheistic. Our God is invisible. He's everywhere. He is the creator God. And thus, monotheism is actually born. And so when they return with the Assyrians, when they're conquered by the Persians, they're allowed to go back to Israel, this educated class, and then they bring a written Torah with them. And thus, that golden age occurs. Of Jewish life. So then it becomes the next kind of story beat of the Jewish story is then the new classical age is in full swing. You have Alexander the Great, notable people, notable things happening. The area is conquered by one empire after another. First the Persians, then the Greeks, and then you have Hellenistic culture, and you kind of start to have some splits between Jews. mostly those that want to assimilate to Greek culture. It is pretty nice. Trade with other Greeks and has its allures. And those that absolutely hate Hellenistic culture, debaucherous and naked wrestling and all that. And all, of course, they're not monotheistic, they have their own gods and they want us to pray to their gods. Oh no. So there's rebellions and a new dynasty is established by the Maccabees. That's the Hanukkah story. That's what Hanukkah celebrates. Then, so amongst those tribulations, those splits, the Roman Empire comes in and there's resistance to them. And then there's a number of revolts. And then basically Jerusalem's completely sacked and destroyed. And thus begins what is called the Jewish diaspora. So basically spread them out, or rather Jewish population have to leave Israel because of all the war. For the same reason that there's a Lebanese diaspora, massive civil war in Lebanon in the last century. And now there's Lebanese people all around opening kebab stands and whatnot. To put a stereotype on it, unfair. Many are also very educated, as immigrant populations will be after a generation or two. And that includes Jewish populations. Get into that later. So I'm reaching the end of this segment, so I'll just fast forward a bit. I wanted to get through at least ancient history here to set up, why are Jews the way they are? So in reaction to having your country destroyed by civil war and the Romans at the same time is to then write down all of the codes, rules that were all oral up till this point. So the Torah was written, the Holy Scriptures, but you didn't have all the other rules and things and the moral laws because it's Jewish monotheism is very rule-based. There's a law, it's eternal, it's an internal morality. It's not based on the context you're in. It's not based on, who's in charge, right? Which was usually the case at the time. Do you bow to the Caesars or do you bow to your one true God? And that was the case with the Jews. So, and that's what made them very resilient to being conquered, being ruled effectively, as it were. But of course, there's always usually a faction who wants to assimilate a little bit more. And that's one of the big questions I'll tackle in the next section. So with that, we have what's called the Talmud, which is the big rule book. And it's massive. It's tons of volumes. There are people, you study it your whole lifetime. It's all you do. It did not turn me on at all when I learned about this. But the Talmud is there, and it grows over time. It has commentary after commentary. And it means that through this adversity and being outsiders, especially after the diaspora, having to settle down in other Greek and Roman colonies and places, there's a necessity to be problem solvers, a necessity to be rationalistic with your approach, because the world is made of laws. Your morality is made of laws, so is the rest of the world. So there's a bit more of a rationalistic thinking when it comes to dealing with the natural world. That's why many scientific advances come from Jews. That's why many philosophical and many other advances, and you have great many leaders in these areas that are Jewish for this reason. Not only because there's a scholarly tradition, more educated, merchant class, so there's always money for people to study and not have to just be subsistence-based, serfs and whatever, but also being isolated and in these urban ghettos. Talking about Jewish history, where I left off, I just left off at the end of the Roman Empire, or at least during it, where the Jewish diaspora takes place, and in reaction, they write the Talmud, so that no matter where they are in the Roman Empire or the world, they can take the law with them. Not only the Holy Book and practice the religion, but of course, Judaism is its practices, its rituals, and so on. And the Talmud is basically the long list of those things. The Torah is like a general gist of it. It's very generalized, the Ten Commandments and what have you. But the Talmud is everything else, all the dietary rules and so on and so on. And some of these things really made a lot of sense in the ancient times. Every rule has a purpose. For example, making shellfish and pork kind of not allowed is based on the fact that it was very hard to clean these animals, and it was usually very dangerous to eat them in ancient times. Shellfish can be disease-ridden, go bad very quickly. The rules kind of comes from an anecdote of ancient times of the, you know, Israel's invaded, the army is, you know, an invading army is besieging them, and, you know, prayers are made and so on. And the army, you know, eats a lot of shellfish because, you know, they just forage around and it's near the coast. And so they eat a bunch of shellfish, but I guess it went bad and they all get sick. And hallelujah, a miracle occurs. The army is beaten by sick shellfish, by eating shellfish. And at least that's the conclusion because they found a bunch of shells around and made a conclusion of, well, this must mean that God hates people, you know, doesn't want anyone to eat shellfish. So we will never eat shellfish. Rules that made a lot of sense before refrigeration, but not so much after, which is why kosher law is a matter of preference and faith than practice and practicality. So, back to the history lecture. I hope you're finding this interesting enough as the way I'm talking about it. So, Jews can practice and have the law with them no matter where they go. So, they retain they're an independent culture that can survive, that's such a strong identity that it resists any form of assimilation. You know, if you're an immigrant and you go somewhere else, you're going, it's assumed you'll take on some characteristics, not only learning the language, but the food, and there's a blending, you know, the melting pot kind of thing. Melting pot is kind of a cliche, and then there's reasons that it's not really accurate. You know, when immigrants come to America, they're just expected to act white, whatever that means, and be less whatever else they were, but not white. You know, Italians had the hard, you know, a longer time to assimilate, as it were, because they have, you know, Sicilians have darker skin. So let's go into the rest of Jewish history after, you know, during the Middle Ages, where, you know, they're stuck in ghettos, you know, isolated urban centers, where, you know, because they, you know, these communities have their own separate culture and language that they speak as well, you know, Hebrew or the prayers, that they can communicate, and it creates a great merchant network. You know, they make good merchants, A, because there's no, unlike Christianity, which comes about in the crisis of the end of the classical age, just as Judaism came about in the crisis of the Bronze Age, new ideas like equality between people and all the ideas imbued in Christianity, early Christianity, and of course, throughout Christianity's history, come about during the end of the Roman era. That, you know, we're all brothers, we're not going to separate ourselves between nationalities as much, at least attempt to, and hold state power accountable. You know, the kings and the emperors, hold them accountable with the church. Where before, with Israel and Judaism, church and state are usually one and the same. King, priests, and what have you. Go skip again. So just like there's usually story beats. Jews usually go where they're most wanted. They leave when they're not wanted, usually by force. You know, early church history is filled with propaganda against Jews. You know, they're the killers of Jesus. That started way back in the beginning. And it only develops further, you know. So any Jewish prejudice usually comes from that there's been 1,000 or so years, 2,000 years worth of negative propaganda, bad press. And it's basically stuff made up about Jews. Usually for, not for the spiritual reasons, but usually because, let's, you know, I mentioned Jews make great merchants because they know other Jews in other places. You have a natural trade network. And so they're out competing you, and you're, you know, a Christian merchant. You just make stuff up about your competitors, and like, oh, they steal babies and eat their blood, drink their blood, stuff like that, or just the usual thing of they killed Jesus, and we shouldn't allow them to be around here. Now, Jews, being an educated, rationalistic sort, they're really useful to have around as far as rulers are concerned. And so, you know, some rulers protect them, kings and what have you. So in Moorish Spain, things were very diverse there, and Jews could climb the social ladder, own property. There's even a Jewish prime minister in Moorish Spain. But that came to an end with the Inquisition in the Renaissance era. And so Jews, again, from that area at least, have to spread out. Some go to the Ottoman Empire, some go to the Caribbean, and start little pirate cells to take revenge on the Spanish. And some go to Holland, where then a robust Jewish community is established there. And so we go through the centuries, and it's when we hit the Enlightenment things that really start to change for Judaism. Oh, yeah, and then the remaining Jews in Eastern Europe, because they were invited there. You know, the Polish king needed merchants and educated people to kind of build up his kingdom. And so he invited Jews to come there. So it went from, you know, 10,000 Jews in that area to hundreds of thousands of Jews. And so that's why you have all those Eastern European Jewish populations. As shown in American Tale, Fievel Goes West. So the Enlightenment is a powerful time, because not only do you have the ideas of mass citizenship, it's the French Revolution really starts to turn things around for Jews who, at this point, were all very isolated. The exceptions were court Jews. These were Jews under the direct protection of nobles and the aristocracy. And so they were educated and, you know, and had the frou-frou fashions. And so they could kind of pull their Jewish brethren out of the ghettos who have been completely isolated. They're still living a medieval life as far as look and living is concerned. And so they're pulled into the Enlightenment era, modern age, little by little. And it really helped. Living the creed of egalitarianism and equality in the French Revolution, Jews are actually given full citizenship rights, which to this point, they were always second-class citizens, always. Always outsiders, always an other. And that creates a mentality that is not easily broken. Or maybe it is. All because we don't have our own country, we don't have our own land, we're always dependent on the protection of the ruling class. If we don't, if we lose that, we are forfeit. And even the strongest Jewish communities, which seem like they'll be there forever, can disappear within weeks. They just disappear as if they were never there. And this occurs over and over and over again. Ancient Alexandria and in Amsterdam, and so on and so on. And it could happen in New York City eventually, New Amsterdam. But not quite yet. We'll get there. Right, and so Napoleon's kind of important because as he conquered Europe or, you know, invaded Russia, he opened the ghettos and established, at least temporarily, Jews have citizenship rights. And at very least, planted the seeds that Jews could live better lives. And so from then on, it was kind of, even if there wasn't state support, there were movements to move forward. And in Germany especially, you have growing ascendancy of Jewish life. And then as a general theme, it came up when I talked about ancient Greeks. And it comes up every so often in Jewish history. The question of assimilation, you know, just as rulers and, you know, and Gentile populations have the Jewish question, which is usually kind of, the final solution to that is genocide, whether it's a alt-righter here in America or a Nazi a century ago. Jewish question on the other side of the coin, when Jews ask a question, it's usually assimilation. How much do we assimilate? How much do we take on the other people's ways? And how far can we go before we stop being Jewish and defining that? You know, it's always you know, the common trope of spread by Jewish comedians. You know, if you get two Jews, you get three opinions or five opinions. This is because we're always arguing with each other and we're always rationalistic and always trying to use reason to sort out issues of identity. And the Jewish identity is very strong because of our laws and our internal morality and the rituals and all that stuff. But then, like, okay, if you stop following all the Talmudic law and start shaving and so on, you know, one of the things Napoleon did was he, when he was reigning, and Sorry, 1808. He had a big like council. He had a big conference with Jewish notables and their rabbis, and his main goal was to assimilate Jews into the French state, which there was a bit of resistance to. But his goal was simply to solve the Jewish question is to assimilate the Jews. You know, make them more French. You know, not only not enough to just speak French, but are you in fact subservient to the French state and French law? And, you know, he asked questions that were debated and which continue to be debated is like, you know, can Jews intermarry? What police power do rabbis have? Can Jews work with non-Jews in the marketplace? And in many areas, like in Germany, the answer was yes. So you have more Jews enter banking and work and so on. And so they go out into the world and build wealth and get educated and participate in life and in some ways assimilate. You know, they shave and so on. And there's all these different movements. Get into the mud there, trying to explain all that. Don't need to. But there's, you know, modern age, massive changes happening on all fronts in all sectors. That includes Jewish life as well. But during this time also, the questions of assimilation are also then the questions of the other side of it is then, well, if we can't assimilate, and many Christians and other people do not want us to assimilate. They don't want us around no matter what, because we're so good at out-competing them in capitalism. We need our own state. We need our own nation. We need our own country. Because along with modernization is nationalism. And so a Jewish nationalism comes about known as Zionism. There are many different types of Zionism. There's a religious kind of Zionism that it is a godly mandate that we return. There's a political type where it's just about having our own political institution that will be secular. And then there's other types as well. There's kind of a labor, a leftist kind of Zionism. And those were the real pioneers because they started communes in Israel, in Levant first. And they were the trailblazers. And Jews do well in various, you know, sectors, philosophy, science, because of this culture of rationalism and internal laws, trying to seek the laws of economics, like Marx, the laws of human psychology, Freud, the laws of matter itself, Einstein, all Jews. And these are the men who, create the modern age itself. So the influence is far beyond the population. Which makes people very nervous, and it makes people very paranoid. And it doesn't help that once the modern age comes about and Jews start kind of spreading out, not having, you know, and changing a bit of the ways and having reform movements, not follow the Talmud to the letter anymore. Jews are never one type of politics. You know, you have just as many left-wing Jews as right-wing Jews. You know, Jews are the leaders of communist organizations. You know, Marx himself, his father was a convert, but more or less he can be identified as such. And so, like, you know, Jews are just as likely to just be called the downfall of society because they're communists, as much as some of them are the downfall of society because they're the bankers. And these are not the same Jews. You know, just as any ethnicity or any social group, we're not all one thing. You know, I mean, I've spoken a few times that if you can say something about Jews, it's that we're rationalistic, that we have a strong internal morality. So we seek, you know, we're very active in struggles for justice because of this. Also because we've always been the exploited class throughout history, you know, since the diaspora. And unless we have our own state, we're an exploited class. We're a second-class citizens. This obviously makes us very much involved in the struggle for justice and freedom, as we always have been. But I'll get on the other side of the next break that I think that is starting to ebb a bit. Because for me, what makes... You know, if I would ever have pride in being Jewish, is because we are internationalist, because we can spread out, and because of our internal morality, it doesn't matter where we live, that we can have solidarity with each other. And that is why, you know, communist organizations and parties were always filled with Jews because we're already internationalists. We're already in solidarity with the exploited. So with that, we'll go to the other side, and then we'll discuss more modern times, the last century, and the question of America and Israel. So enjoying with that, really sticky. We'll see what happens.
Netanyahu's in a tizzy. His eyes are filled with hate. He said the problem with those Arabs is they won't recognize a Jewish state. He said those Palestinians just won't come around to accepting Jewish rule on their holy ground. He said the Arabs don't accept their new neighbors in the hood. Those ungrateful regimes just don't respect us as they should. Well, I don't want to upset anyone or unduly take to task, but if a state wants recognition, it seems reasonable to ask. Where are your borders drawn in black and white? Do they include the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights? Let me repeat the question. Where are your borders drawn in black and white? Do they include the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights? I heard him speaking to the Congress, getting his 29th standing O. He said, we need our security from those terrorists, don't you know? If you want security, I wonder if you'd say it's true that the Palestinians should have security too. 'Cause if you want security, it seems only fair that you should also grant it to the people over there. And maybe you could answer, though the question is a sin, just where your country ends and where your neighbor's lands begin. Where are your borders drawn in black and white? Do they include the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights? Where are your borders drawn in black and white? Do they include the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights? He said, we're the only democracy in the Middle East. Or actually, he said, the only viable one, at least. The PA isn't viable, because they didn't vote Abbas. They voted for those terrorists that they call Hamas. So we can't recognize them, though we wish they would agree that we stole their land quite fairly here by the Mediterranean Sea. We stole it fair and square. We stole it, just like you. If you don't like it, you're an anti-Semite, be you a Muslim or a Jew. Okay, right. But tell me, where are your borders drawn in black and white? Do they include the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights? Where are your borders drawn in black and white? Do they include the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights?
So, when I last left off, I was covering Jewish history and giving a very boilerplate version of it all, but still kind of a little more than my history book in Hebrew school told me. I had to dig myself a bit for some of this information. And of course, it's always still changing. A better archaeology about ancient times for a more complete picture of what was really happening. So we're just not using the Bible as our main source, as many archaeologists, when archaeology was a new practice, a new science was being developed, you know, they were using the Bible was their only guide. Now we're trying to find other things. So anyway, totally off track here. When I left off, I was talking about the discussion of why, you know, what makes me proud to be Jewish. And usually it's our internationalism, it's an internal morality, a thirst for justice, being a constant underdog throughout human history. Second-class citizens, always being pushed around. Makes us all very it gives us a good sense of humor, great comedians and so on. And just generally going about there's a Jewish concern in banking and a Jewish concern in science. You know, it seems like we're everywhere. And why we do so well and so successful, especially in modern era. Once we start assimilating a little bit, as far as maybe not following all kosher law to the letter, but still retaining a strong Jewish identity based on our internal morality, you know, being law-based, being based on these rules passed down generation to generation. But it's not just the rules themselves, it's the mindset of them. Mindset of being rationalism, mindset of problem-solving, probably based on the necessity of always being outsiders. What happens if we stop being outsiders? What happens when we're the insiders? And that's where I think, you know, when if I'm to say when Jews go astray, it's when we become billionaires and nationalistic governments. And that's why I'm not a Zionist. I don't support Israel, even in its own. There was a necessity in it, and it's kind of why, as an idea and as its existence, it's worked out. It's been successful as a colonialist project, the imperialist thing that it is. It has worked out because the assimilation of European Jews wasn't enough. Still, outsiders, you know, can be blamed for anything because of the diversity in thought that we have. You know, we have Jewish rich people, and we have Jewish scientists, and we have Jewish socialists. So it seems like no matter who you are, you can blame us for everything. And we were. And thus the Holocaust ensued. And so with that, Judaism in Europe was completely destroyed. Not completely, of course, but the survivors are much, you know, it is 6 million people. I mean, and it's quite a death blow to what existed in Europe. And so the survivors had to go to Israel, more or less. I mean, where else could they go? So many countries were blocking them out. And even Britain, who had control of Palestine at the time, didn't want more Jews moving there because there was already high tensions from all the Jews that had moved there before World War II. And that set up their communes and their communities legally, but had now were coming under attack because, well, with so many Jews moving there, it does, you know, if you're a native, if you're a Palestinian, it is kind of you have the same paranoia and real concerns about being replaced, as it were. And as far as many Palestinians are concerned, they were driven out of their homes during the Jewish War for Independence, as it's called. They call it something else. They call it the disaster. And what it was is, and it's kind of a lesson of how, this is not just in terms of, you know, just an Israeli thing, but in most history, when it comes to who wins an internal political struggle, it's usually the most militant faction, the one who's willing to go the furthest to use violence. This is not always a happy thing to state, but in terms of Jewish history, Israeli history, you know, the reason why, you know, there was always voices trying to work for peace and cooperation, and there was a movement, a small movement, to create a secular state that could, where there would be shared political power once Britain left. But instead, once Britain left, the Jewish militias took power and then drove Palestinians out and said, this is Israel now. So it seemed like the fears of local Arabs that were attacking them seemed to come to fruition. Whether or not it was self-fulfilling or not is, well, something that we should all keep in mind when we are taking action in our own lives and thinking about what to do about our problems. What problems are self-fulfilling? And certainly when it comes to nationalists and demagogues and fascists, it all seems self-fulfilling. You keep being afraid of everyone and you make everyone your enemy. And that was some of the case there. And that's been the case with Israel. The narrative is, and the history I was taught as a kid, was that Jews always want peace and Arabs always want war. And you look into their real history and that is not the case at all. At all. It's not the case now. It's not the case then. It's not the case in any other time. What makes it most gets the most press and the most attention is, of course, the most militant wing of a faction. A faction of Palestinians, you know, Hamas is the most militant, so they won some elections. They won out. And that's just in the recent decades. But to the general question of assimilation, you know, Jews in America are always posed with how assimilated are we? You know, are we still Jews if we can even identify as white and take part in the buying of our election system? You know, we have Soros, a liberal billionaire who funds liberal projects around the world and liberal NGOs. And you have Adelson, a Jewish billionaire who funds Republican politicians by the dozens and secures funding and billions of dollars of military support for Israel. And so many Israeli Jews have dual citizenship as Americans. So our foreign policies are American foreign policy. Sometimes it's a tail wags the dog situation. What America does in the Middle East concerning Iran, Saudi Arabia, is all based on what Israeli security concerns are. And recently, in the last few years, Israel is working more closely with Saudi Arabia. You'd think it would be strange bedfellows, but as far as fighting Iran and keeping Syria in chaos and Iraq a shell of its former self, Israel is now safer than ever. Because the rest of the area region is on fire, just the way the war party in Israel likes it, and they've been in power for quite a while now. The Israeli left is not what it used to be. It used to be very strong. There was the Labor Party was in control for decades, and that's when the peace process was the most there. But some of their leaders were assassinated by militant Jews. So the militant faction, whether it be Jews or Arab, seems to win out and seems to kind of win out as far as like who has the stronger argument. There's no stronger argument than assassinating a leader and then stalling a peace process for another decade, if it even was existing in the first place. But now the movement for peace for Palestinians by Palestinians. Is a movement for justice, is a movement against apartheid, and thus the BDS movement. So now, our ruling class, our politicians, both Democrat and Republican, are like, no, Israel is our closest ally. We're going to pass laws against free speech to ban any boycotting of Israel, which is the BDS movement, boycott, divest, sanction. And you see in Israel, very fascist tendencies, nationalistic tendencies, calls to kill all the Arabs, just kill them all. They're dogs. Not only are Palestinians second-class citizens, they are dirt, murdered with impunity almost, with very little. Like, they kill journalists, they bomb the hell out of Gaza all the time, making unilateral war, it's isometric warfare. Oh, but Palestinians threw some rocks or Palestinians shot some rockets. That makes them the worst. They're the ones that want war. Israel wants peace. Well, sure, it's all very complicated if you look at it in terms of who shot first or who shoots the most. But it's always a matter of looking at who has the power in this situation, and it is Israel that has the most power, especially when it has the superpower America having its back in terms of money and support, and Saudi Arabia as a fellow regional ally who is a monarchy, very oppressive to its citizens, very exploitative towards its land, and is currently waging genocide in Yemen because Yemen has a faction in it that's supportive of Iran. They don't want to pick sides. It's all kinds of stuff that we're helping participate in. And sometimes when it gets on the news, it's just when a bus full of kids gets blown up. Which is, of course, angering and tragic, but it's just kind of a symbol, almost, of the ongoing disaster, human or otherwise, occurring in the Middle East, as Israel, as a whole, becomes more nationalistic and more hyper-religious, and I'm just not seeing what I was proud of as being Jewish anymore there, in that, that's culture of. Because it's a question of, like, once we have our own state, we don't need to play nice with anyone. You don't have to have all the things that, you're not the, once you're not the underdog anymore, you're now the overdog. You're the one being the bully. You're the one who uses violence to solve all their problems because you have that monopoly. You have that right, to say that might makes right. Or that, in your own defense, everything is permissible. There's a nationalism is cancerous. And even and other Jews that were more internationalist, like Einstein, like Marx, like others, intellectual leaders, were always against nationalism. They were always critiquing the dangers of fascism and the nationalist movements in Europe and how they were dangerous for Jews, as they obviously were. But they were also probably, maybe I have to look into it, were they critical of the Zionist project? There was a big split and debate about Zionism, and should we, do we even need this Jewish state? You know, it's okay to, for some of us to move there, but does it need to be a Jewish state? And that is kind of the overall solution, is to make Israel secular, to which, counter to that, just recently this year, the Knesset, the parliament there, passed a resolution saying that Israel is an explicitly Jewish state, meaning if you're not Jewish, you're second class. If not in name, certainly in name, in practice, is also the case. Certainly if you're a Palestinian living in the West Bank, in Gaza, you most certainly are. You're practically a prisoner. These are prison camps. Open air, very large, but still prison camps. Because you can't move freely, you can't trade freely, you know, there's embargoes in place. It's a disaster, humanitarian or otherwise. Just because of how oppressive and exploitative it all is. So please support the BDS movement in our final moments. And just make a general call from what I've been talking about, Jewish history, that what is the future of Jewishness, you know? And I have fears that as Israel develops down its current course, and this is something other left-wing Jews kind of point out, Chapa Trap House is an example, that they're getting the world they want. You know, a world that hates Jews by proxy of hating Israel means that Jews will not be welcome where they live. You know, American Jews are under attack, metaphorically, by right-wingers who are, yes, have become very anti-Semitic. I mean, it was always there, but now they're just talking freely for it. And the recent massacre is a test that, you know, that's the result. And that's okay, one guy. But there could be more. And it could be a movement. And that's the fascist movement in America, and that's why Antifa is about fighting that. Because as long as you're fighting the fascist movement, it doesn't coalesce, and it doesn't become a whole militia going about massacring Jews. It stays as just one guy who flies off the handle. Because it's not organized, right? As long as you're not organized, it's always going to be individuals lashing out, whether it be you, me, or anybody. And a misunderstanding of Jews that have power and Jews that don't have power. And Jews have been very successful in America because they have that mercantile acuity. They are very successful as capitalists. And they're also very successful as socialists for almost the same reason, just being rationalistic. Rationalistic doesn't really say anything about how what your politics will be, but just that you'll be really good when you do something. That you'll be a great problem solver, as it were. The very thing that we try to teach ourselves in high schools and put in the curriculums, but because it's so standardized and machine-like and prison-like, that it's not really going to happen really well. So with that, I'm going to wrap up with the housekeeping. So this has been Dan Platt with the Three Left Show. We are podcasted at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and any other podcast app you have or use. We can be found at 3lefts.news. That is the website, 3lefts.news. That is all it is. There is a full archive of episodes from the year, and it'll be uploaded there in a week or so. The next show live will be in 2 weeks, maybe sooner. No, most definitely 2 weeks. And I'll see you then. Thank you for joining me. It has been a pleasure.